Good morning and welcome to this March 30th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors about not only their books, but their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that go into creating compelling fiction and occasionally nonfiction, poetry, and short stories. Elizabeth Strout is with me this morning, a huge pleasure. She is the author of several novels, including Abide With Me, national bestseller and Book Sense pick, and Amy and Isabel, which won the Los Angeles Times Art Seidenbaum Award for First Fiction and the Chicago Tribune Heartland Prize, and was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and the Orange Prize in England. In 2009, she was awarded the Pulitzer for her book Olive Kittredge. Her short stories have been published in a number of magazines, including The New Yorker. She teaches at the Master of Fine Arts program at Queen's University of Charlotte. But it is her latest novel, My Name is Lucy Barton, that we're chatting about this morning. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here. Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming on. So I'm going to let you kind of take us into the world of My Name is Lucy Barton and kind of introduce us to the novel, these two women, and tell us what was kind of on your mind when you created this world.
Right. Well, Lucy Barton, My Name is Lucy Barton, it surprised me as a book, which is good. They always should surprise me to some extent. But this was a little bit more of a surprise than my other books. First of all, because it's written in first person, and that was a change for me. And it takes place, it's looking back, a woman looks back on her life and many, many years ago when she was in the hospital for an appendectomy that something went wrong and nobody ever really found out why, but she spends many weeks in the hospital. And so her mother, from whom she's estranged, comes to visit her for 5 days and sits at the foot of the bed. And that's really what cradles the novel and structures it in many ways, is their conversations back and forth within those 5 days. And Lucy has come from tremendous poverty, and she's broken through the class system of this country and wound up arguably an upper middle class woman who lives in New York City.
It's really interesting to me because my experience of this book, and I think it was some other people's experience of the book, is that the first pass through felt very, you know, if you were to tell the story as you just did, you know, it kind of feels like a very straightforward story. And the more passes through you take, the kind of deeper and deeper it gets. And I had noticed this when I went through some Goodreads reviews of it, and people kept changing their star rating of it, saying, I thought it was kind of a simplistic, not a simplistic book, but, you know, I thought it was kind of a straightforward book. And the more time I spend with it and the more time I think about it and the more time I go back, the deeper and deeper and deeper it gets. And I was wondering if that was your experience writing it as well.
I think my experience writing it was that I did have a sense of how deep I was hoping that it would go. So I'm glad to hear that people, you know, have returned to it or are finding it, you know, stays with them or something. Because I did have the sense as I was writing it that the simplicity of the voice or the purity of Lucy's voice is there's much, much that goes beneath it.
Right. And the other thing that I, you know, you brought up your interest in class, and I think your interest in class and class structure permeates a number of your books. It sounds like it's been on your mind for,
right,
you know, for some time. And I think both the New York Times and the Washington Post, a couple of reviews, had brought up The Great Gatsby, which I wouldn't have thought of when I was reading it myself. But I thought that was interesting to have, you know, the Chrysler Building is sort of this beacon outside of Lucy's window is kind of this, you know, symbol of class and where she's come from. Can you talk a little bit about your sort of what has drawn you to the class topic and kind of what each of these novels has revealed to you about that?
Right. Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear you say that class has been in my work previously, because I think it has. And yet I never, I don't hear people talk about that part of it that much, probably because we're still not talking about class as much as we should in this country. But with Amy and Isabel, it was very striking to me, even as I was working on that many, many years ago, that, you know, Isabel is working among working class women in a shoe factory, and she feels that she should be doing something else. She feels that she should be a teacher or a professional, and that's her story and how she has to deal with that. And that sort of came to me organically. I mean, I was simply writing about the office room in this factory, and then when the book was done, I realized, wait a minute, this is actually about class. And that sort of made me understand that this is something that I have recognized intuitively. And then as I went forward, I have thought that in Burgess Boys, my book before Lucy Barton, was very straightforwardly about three different siblings. Each of them have landed in a different class of this country, and what their lives have been like as a result of that. So I'm glad you recognize that. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm always interested in seeing how books are in conversation with each other. And you know, I mean, the mother in this, mm-hmm. in Lucy Barton, is obviously very different than the mother than Olive or your other characters. And yet, mm-hmm. I still continue to feel like there is some conversation between your novels, and class is certainly one example of that. Do you think about it in terms of kind of the novels as a continuum, or parts of one big mosaic, or am I making sense?
That's a good question, actually. Well, you know, when I'm working on something, I'm just working on that. And yet I do think that all my work has connecting tissue, sort of, so to speak, you know, between the books. There's something that I hope makes it recognizably still mine, even though they're pretty different from one another. But so it's something I'm a little bit aware of it, but I'm still, when I'm writing something, I'm just really trying to get down as truthfully as I can what it is I'm working on at that moment. But yes, there's certainly mother-daughter issues, mother-son issues, very different mothers, as you said, but there's still that thing that I'm obviously drawn back to some extent, and the class thing as well, yeah.
Now, your comment about the mother-daughter relationships, I really love this idea of adult relationships between mothers and daughters. And, you know, I think they're just incredibly interesting, how that transition is made from dependency to independence, and who's dependent on whom, and what's appropriate and reasonable to ask each other, you know, all those questions. And, you know, I was kind of wondering if what this book kind of revealed to you about adult mothers and daughters, if anything, and kind of how you think about that relationship, because it's just fraught with peril, I think.
Oh yes, it certainly can be, and that's, you know, novelist dream to have something fraught with peril, of course. I don't know that I was thinking so much of the idea of mothers and daughters and grown daughters as much as I was just really trying to write Lucy's particular story. But certainly, and their story is different in the sense that they have been estranged. There's this separateness that's been taking place ever since Lucy's left home. So, but yeah, it's an interesting, very interesting territory, particularly for Lucy's generation and that mother. I mean, my generation of having children, I think there's been a big shift. But, you know, how our adult children will view us, I don't know.
Right, right. And, you know, a sense of place has always been so important in all of your work, although this sense of place is different than obviously the main stories and the New Hampshire stories. And I had heard that you kind of have to have a 15-year or 12-year lag time distance from a place to write about it effectively. Can you talk a little bit about the bringing these places to life? The Midwest is so such a visceral spot.
Right, exactly. You know, I think I said that years ago. And I'm not sure, but I think I must have said that at least a few years ago, because I think the lag time has shortening as I get older, is what I'm saying. New York, I've lived in for many, many years, and I have, you know, finally did write about that in the Burgess Boys and also Lucy Barton. But the Midwestern setting was, that was part of the surprise of that book for me, because I realized my husband and I had just been out in the Midwest. You know, I've been there a number of times, but we had just been there, and I realized, wait, this is where Lucy Barton comes from. It was just so clear to me with that sense of sky and the houses just sort of dotted, you know, here and there along the horizon. And so once I realized that, it was exciting, and then we kept going back out, you know, making sure I had different things right and stuff. But it was a surprise. That was a surprise for me that she would come from the Midwest.
Do you have models that you were able to draw that level of poverty from? I mean, her level of poverty growing up was so stark. You know, were there inspirations for that?
When I was growing up in New Hampshire and Maine, there were always a few families, and it's been my experience that, and I'm sure it's true in the city as well, but the city would have a very different feel to it and a different look. But it's been my experience that in rural areas, there's always one family that is so poor that they are ostracized just because of their poorness. And certainly when I was growing up, there were a few families that was the story of. And they came to me, those particular children, did help inform Lucy's story for me. You know, the teacher who says, nobody's too poor to buy a bar of soap. And it's something that I heard my third grade teacher say to a child sitting in front of me, who's now passed away. But these things stayed with me as, you know, horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My guest this morning is Elizabeth Strout. The book is My Name is Lucy Barton. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I think it's interesting that all with the exception of Bide With Me, are names of the characters, you know, Olive Kittredge and My Name is Lucy Barton. And I think it's such a declaratory statement to name yourself and to claim who you are. I mean, even the Burgess Boys is kind of a takeoff on, you know, the people are claiming their identity. I was wondering if that was a conscious decision of naming people in the titles of the books.
You know, again, that came because I think I'm just so character driven as a writer. I'm so interested in people. I'm just so interested in people, much more than I am necessarily, you know, ideas, although hopefully ideas come from my interest in people, but I'm very, very character driven, and so I will, you know, call the book what seems to be the most direct title, and they have been the people that I'm writing about. I've often thought that Abide With Me should have been called The Tale of Tyler Caskey. Really, I wish I could go back and rename it, since Tyler Caskey it's really his tale. But my name is Lucy Barton. The fact that I called it My Name is Lucy Barton as opposed to Lucy Barton is because of her recognition that the teacher, you know, Sarah Payne, couldn't even really say her name when Lucy came across her in the store that day. Mm-hmm. And so there's that cumulative effect that Lucy has as the book goes on, so that she finally makes the statement, My name is Lucy Barton.
I love it. It's always a risky move to make a character in the book a writer, but
that was very risky, yes.
But I enjoyed it, and you know, there are so many pearls of writing wisdom in here, and you know, it's interesting to see a writer reflect on being a writer and a writer reflect on being a writing teacher, and the vulnerability of writers and
right,
whole profession.
Right, That was also a surprise for me to have her a writer.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, if that was there from the beginning or if that that had to be pulled out of you.
No, it was not. It was not from the beginning. And I was probably about a third of the way through it. I never write anything from beginning to end, you know, in consecutively, but I was messing around with Lucy's story for quite some time, and probably about a third of the way through the whole process of writing the book, I realized, oh, let's make her a writer. And it was because when she stays after school and she reads and she discovers the joy of reading, and then I thought, okay, so she's going to be a writer. And I was nervous about that. I was. It was a leap for me to make her not just first person, but then to be a writer. And I thought, oh, well, okay, let's go for it. So I did.
And you had talked about always writing things that have a sense of urgency, that you write more scenes than you worry about plot, and you just keep, accumulating scene after scene after scene to see what the plot becomes. I think that's
right.
That's a really interesting way to write. So it's So tell me about how that kind of worked with this book, what the scenes were that accumulated to say, okay, here's how I'm going to structure this as a book.
Right. Right. Well, I work on many things at one time for quite a while, and then something will pull itself forward and demand that I, spend my time only with that thing. And so it was that way with Lucy Barton. There were many things that were going around my table, and many little pieces of scenes. And Lucy's first scenes were with her mother in that hospital and different pieces of conversation. And but I didn't really think that I would end up writing it. And so, but they kept coming around. And so I kept looking at them and thinking, oh, okay. So I did do many different scenes of Lucy at different points in her life and this and that. And then it just sort of unfolded. Well, not just sort of. That makes it sound easier than it was, but but it did eventually show itself to me, and in that way, it wasn't unlike how I write most of my books, which is to just let the scenes play themselves out and to see which ones have the most life to them, and then they do often show themselves in a connecting way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you said this is your first book in first person.
Yes, yes.
Which is also scary, it seems like.
That was scary, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And one of the things that worried me about it is that I think sometimes first-person narration can feel a little, can make the reader feel like there's this person in their head too much, sort of like I. And I was worried about that. And then when I finally realized, well, wait a minute, I can write this from, a retrospective, so that it begins with Lucy looking back. And the distance, I think, helped my worry about that, that there would be some distance so that the writer wouldn't feel like Lucy was just jumping around inside their head all the time.
Right, right. Let's talk about the mother character, because she... Mm-hmm. She's so much on the page and yet so inaccessible. I love
exactly.
her, and I don't really, I mean, I don't love her, but I love her
right.
character. I don't,
right.
but she's the most difficult to understand, and she's the most difficult to kind of get into her history of what's making her tick. And was that your experience as writer as well, that she, or do you really feel like you have a great grasp on all dimensions of her?
Well, I feel that I know her, better in some ways probably than the reader, but I really, this was Lucy's story, and because it's Lucy's story and because it's first person, I had to remember constantly that Lucy is the only person that we're going to really know what she sees. I mean, how we see the mother is only from Lucy's point of view, and because Lucy's mother is Lucy's mother, and that particularity of their relationship is just, she's a mystery to Lucy, and so I had to make her a mystery on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, there's an extremeness to their situation, but I think that we don't know our parents really as well as we think we do, or as well as we might want to. And so I just push that to an extreme, of course, and so Lucy doesn't really ever quite know what her mother's childhood was like, what her mother was talking about when she said, well, you can take catnaps because they make you feel safe. I mean, these were certain things that Lucy just had to live with that she never understood and never would find out about her mother. And so the mysteriousness of who these people are to us is put in the stream there, I think.
And it's so effective that way. I mean, that was my experience of the mother-daughter relationship and how fraught with peril they are, that there's this extreme need to be known by your mother for some reason.
Yeah.
And there's and some sort of, you know, desire to know your mother as well. But this really primal desire,
yes,
to be seen, and they just can't get there. And that was so.
You're exactly right. It really is. You're absolutely right about the relationship. It's so much more important to the child that they be seen than it is that they really know who their mother is. I mean, that might come much later, but always there is that desire, you know, mommy, look at me,
right,
you know, and her mother can't really quite do that.
And kind of specifically denies her. I mean, when she went to her,
yeah,
and said, I wrote these stories, and then, you know, her mother won't even acknowledge that and then says, well, they were kind of stupid stories, or you know, she belittles her own work.
Right.
In the eyes of her mother is authentic,
and
true,
then,
and painful.
Yeah. Yeah. But then later on, the mother will say, well, you know, Lucy, write this one down if you want a good story. Write this one down. So the mother is a little bit on her daughter's side.
Yeah.
Eventually, you know, but there's terrible ambiguity and ambivalence as well.
Right, right. What were the big stopping points in this book that gave you the kind of the biggest challenges and how you overcame them? And were they different challenges from some of the other novels?
Yeah. Well, the first person, as I said, that was certainly the biggest challenge for me with this book,
yeah,
was how was I going to handle the first person and how was I going to make that palatable for the reader, you know, and so that was the biggest. That was the biggest. And then I think that was the biggest, really. And you know, having her a writer made me a little uneasy. But once I decided to do that, you know, then I just did it. So
yeah.
But that was something I did have to think about.
And
but I think otherwise, you know, it was like any other book, it's just a matter of staying with it until it shows itself.
It sounds like this one came, I don't know if it came easier, but it sounds like it came faster for you than some of the other books.
It did come faster. It did come faster. The Burgess voice, well, that took me a long time because I had to research the Somali community. And, you know, so there were 7 years of just researching for the Burgess voice. And this one, I really, you know, except for going back to the Midwest a number of times, this was a much more internal kind of book, you know.
Right, right. Do you experience the books differently once they're out in the world and kind of, you know, the greater world has a chance to digest and talk to you about them? Do they become something different over time in your head than they were when you were conceiving of them?
Yes, they do. That's a good question. It's hard to say. Well, you know, there's an intimacy for me with the characters as I'm working on them, and I'm very often thinking of a reader during many of the drafts that I go through because I write for a reader, you know. So it's not that the book is always privately mine, but in reality, it is mine until it's published, and so there's an intimacy as I work on it and sort of almost a secretiveness and a furtiveness to my working. And then when it goes out into the world, it's like, oh, okay. And so, you know, I very often don't look at it again, or not for a while, you know, because it just changes the relationship that I have with the book. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, yeah. And I love this idea that you're so interested in character over plot, or so interested in wanting to,
yeah.
I think I've heard you say you actually want to, you know, experience being other people, and this is the best way you can,
right,
experience being another person.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think some of your techniques for that are just, you know, eavesdropping and listening and kind of, you know,
always watching, always, ever since I was, you know, I mean, from my earliest memory, I can just remember being so interested in other people and just constantly watching and, you know, what they're wearing, what they're saying. I love cell phones. Everybody complains about cell phones, but I love them because, you know, we can hear half a conversation. And you know, so I'm always watching, and just almost, you know, even as I walk down the sidewalk, sometimes I almost, you know, half become the person I'm watching. It's just so natural to me at this point, you know.
And that's always been true for you, that you were always kind of an observer.
Yeah.
I kind of like that you came to publishing. I know you didn't come to writing anywhere near late, but you came to publishing sort of in your 40s.
And Yeah, early 40s.
I like that there's, you know, some level of life experience and maturity and digesting of the world, you know, before you start knocking out books.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I really had to teach myself how to write. That took me forever. I had to go over and over and over my sentences and teach myself how to get into the darker crevices of the mind that I wanted, you know, that knife to go into. And that took me an awful long time. And it just took me a long time to get on my feet as a published writer. But I agree. I'm not sorry that it didn't happen earlier.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's some advantage to
there is.
Not having cringeworthy stuff of your 20s out there. I wouldn't want anything from my 20s out.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, sadly, we're drawing down on our time. My guest this morning is Elizabeth Strout. The book is My Name is Lucy Barton. And there's actually a lot of good writing advice in the book. You know, like if you're protecting anybody on the page, you're doing it wrong. And I don't know, a bunch of these things. But I was wondering if you could leave us with writing advice that you've garnered over time for our listening writers out there.
You know, I think the best writing advice that I can give anybody, and boy, I can give it because I did it, is just don't stop. If you really want to be a writer, and if you really know that you're a writer, just don't stop. Just keep going and keep going and keep going and keep reading and keep writing, and you will eventually get better. You just will. That's what I think.
Yeah. That is the best writing, the most painful and the best writing advice.
The
tenacious win the day. That's true.
There's nothing too romantic about it. You just keep doing it.
That's right. Elizabeth Strout, this was an enormous pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, well, thank you. They were wonderful questions, and I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Don Mackin will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We have direct downloads of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews up there, as well as information on upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We are on Facebook, we are on Stitcher, we're on Twitter. No reason not to listen. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I am pleased to be in studio with Dawn Mackin. She is an award-winning journalist who spent nearly a decade on her grandfather's story. Previously, she covered health and social issues for Salon, Smart Money, and Newsday, where her investigative series on assisted living facilities poor care helped prompt legislative reform. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Elle, the Sunday Times Magazine, the LA Times, and elsewhere. But it is her book, part memoir, part reportage, The 100-Year Walk, An Armenian Odyssey, that we're talking about this morning. Dawn lives in Southern California and is in studio with me this morning, which is a huge added treat. Dawn, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for coming in. That's fun. I never get guests, so I had to put clothes on this morning.
It's wonderful for me too.
So I talked to so many writers who say that they kind of felt compelled to write the book, that, you know, something possessed them. And for you, it almost sounded like this was the book you for a while didn't want to write, and, you know, that you kind of had resisted writing, and then it found you nonetheless, and you felt compelled to write it in the end, but it was a process getting there. So kind of take us into the story of how the book came to be, a little bit about the book, and to kind of take us into this world.
Absolutely. So my mother would always tell me when I was a child about my grandfather and what he went through during World War I and how he had barely survived the Armenian Genocide. But as a child, I really couldn't understand much about it, much more about him besides him, you know, he was he crossed the desert and he was trying to escape from people trying to kill him. And he ended up drinking his own urine in order to survive. And that was a very strange thing to hear as a child, because you can't comprehend a situation. You know, you have all the food and water and you're safe, you're watching your cartoons, and you can't you can't even comprehend a situation like that where someone would be so desperate that they would do that. And so I grew up with these fragments, but I didn't understand the context. I didn't understand more about it until I was an adult. And he had written down what happened to him, but it was in Armenian, and I can't read or write Armenian. I'm half Armenian and very American. And it was only when I was an adult and a relative translated his journals into English and I could read it for the first time. And when I read it, I actually, because I didn't really know him, he died when I was a kid. So I was reading his journals as if it were someone else's book, you know, first person account. And I could not believe what he had endured, and I had to stop myself and remind myself that if this protagonist did not make it out of this situation where the gendarmes are chasing him or, you know, pointing guns at him on the river's edge, that I wouldn't, my mother wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be here, my whole family, generations of my family wouldn't be here. And but so after reading my grandfather's account, finally, I knew I had to tell his story.
And your mom was really instrumental in that. I mean, she really wanted his story told, right?
Absolutely. She also had grown up since she was a child hearing these same stories. And it was, my grandfather believed he lived in order to tell his story. So it was, you know, other families, you know, you inherit things in your family line, and this was the story that I inherited, and so I had to tell it.
It's funny you use that word, because Aline Ohanessian was in probably 6 months ago talking about also the Armenian genocide. She wrote a novel about that, and we talked a lot about inherited grief and how grief is passed down through the generations, almost like PTSD is passed down through the generations. And I'm imagining that your grandfather's parenting of your mother and, you know, perhaps her parenting of you is really informed by this desperation, or informed by, I think there was a point in which your grandfather said he didn't want to go to a wedding because he couldn't handle joy. He didn't want to be around happiness because of all the people that he saw who didn't make it out. And that's got to impact a whole family line, that line of thinking.
Absolutely. And that was my parents' wedding. He almost didn't show up to my parents' wedding because it was too difficult for him to see joy. And he had seen so many people die that it was difficult for him. I think it, definitely for my mother's generation, for me, it was more of a, it was more of just a real responsibility to tell his story, because it's an incredible story. It's a survival story, and it's there's many parts that's very sad, and you just can't believe that anyone could do this to a whole group of people. But it's also incredibly inspiring, and that's what I take from it, and it just lifts me up, because he overcame incredible odds. And he did it with nothing. It just, you know, being cunning and smart and constantly drawing on a deep well of strength, even when he thought there was nothing left, in order to overcome these odds and live and get back to his family again. The book is really about family. It's about three generations of my family. And it's about getting home again and trying to do everything in order to do that.
Right, right. So I should tell the listeners that the book is sort of told, it's kind of braided between his story and the things that you were able to garner from his journals, and then your own story, because you bravely traveled to some really scary parts of the world to retrace his steps, parts of the world that are now controlled by ISIS. So talk a little bit about your own journey and, you know, your decision to go and what you encountered there, and kind of take us into that side of the story.
Sure. So I guess, well, the book opens with me leaving New York, which is where I was a magazine writer, and, leaving everything my whole life to move back to Los Angeles and tell my grandfather's story. And as I said, it was just this real need. But once I got there, I was like, what did I just do? I just gave up everything.
Right.
No life. But then we found more of my grandfather's journals. And so it just really opened up this world of what he went through, like detailing his life in his town before the war. And before the war, his town, which was right outside, was about 100 miles east of modern day Istanbul, was just this, you know, this place where all different ethnicities and my grandfather switching between languages to sell his goods. And you know, he was starting his own business. And then as the, you read through his journals and you see the kind of coming of the darkness of like the war breaking out in 1914, World War One, and then the decision to deport all the Armenians from their homes, and that was his, you know, including his family, and as they were pushed east, and my grandfather was separated from his family, and he was pushed into what's now the Syrian desert, which, yes, as you said, ISIS controls. So it's just eastern Syria, on the border of modern day Iraq. So I had to, once I read my grandfather's journals, I had to see this land that was the desert is almost like another character in the book, mm-hmm. because it's such a big part of his experience, because he's alone for a lot of it. And he's, you know, in these caravans where they're just being driven on a death march, they're being driven to their deaths, and the caravan just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And then ultimately his caravan is massacred and he's one of the few survivors. So I retraced his steps. I basically made this itinerary, wrote down everywhere that he went, and decided to just follow his nearly 1,000 mile journey from outside from his town, across the middle of Turkey, and then over into Syria, and then along the Euphrates. But this was before. This was in 2007, and then I returned again to Syria in 2009 before the war.
Okay, but it was scary for you. I mean, you were followed, right?
Yes, in both countries.
In both countries. They don't like you talking about the Armenian genocide when you're in Turkey, I imagine.
No,
since they're still denying it.
No.
So yeah, I mean, this was I really like the structure of the book being, you know, it adds a lot of breath and a lot of breaks to have your story interwoven with his. And talk a little bit about his experience being taken in by the Sheikh and your experience meeting the Sheikh and how that all came about.
Sure. That's one of my favorite parts of his story, which was, so he escapes from his caravan just before almost everyone is massacred, and is just desperate for refuge. And he was the Armenians were a minority Christian group within the Ottoman Empire, and so at the time there's a lot of propaganda that the Armenians were dangerous. They were siding with the enemy, which was Russia during the time. And so my grandfather was desperate for refuge, and he heard about this, you know, Muslim Arab sheikh. And so my grandfather decides he's going to try to blend in and pretend he's also Muslim Arab in the area. And so he changes his dress, and he, you know, had learned a little Arabic by then. And the Sheikh knew who my grandfather was. He knew he was an Armenian. But he took him in anyway. He did not listen to the propaganda that this group was a dangerous group and you should stay away from them. In fact, they should be killed. But the Sheikh took him in, and my grandfather became like a son to him and lived with them and became a shepherd. And just, he had this incredible experience with this clan. And so when I set out to retrace my grandfather's steps, it was really important to me to try to see if I could find this clan. And I did. I was able to find them. And it was one of the most incredible moments of my life, and to go to the village. And as I, when we found them, they knew I was coming. When we drove up to the village, I saw all these people standing outside, but I thought that the mosque had just let out and people were just leaving a service, because there were 300 people outside. And it was only when I got out of the car and everyone started rushing toward me with hugs and kisses, and the women whisked me away. And it was almost a Cinderella like moment where, you know, off went my dusty travel clothes and on came this beautiful dress and headscarf, and they had a feast for me, and they took me in, and I was a stranger from a world away, and they just, regardless of ethnicity or religion, they accepted me. And it really says a lot about the people, the civilians from this region that we're hearing a lot about on the news now, because they're just incredible people. And it's very sad for me about what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always important to put books in their time context and realize that nothing is more, they continue to be so relevant today, and with the Syrian refugee crisis and our own domestic elections right now with some of the, you know, I mean, the same conversations and the same topics. You're right. History continues, sadly, to repeat itself. And a book from 100 years ago, you know, events from 100 years ago are never more relevant than they are.
Absolutely. Right now. Absolutely. Because where my grandfather escaped and so many Armenians perished, it's the same area where there's genocide going on now. And so, yes. So it's my grandfather's story. It has a lot of the same things that we're seeing today, but it's also about crossing the boundaries of religion and ethnicity and connecting, which is what happened 100 years ago with my grandfather and this clan, and what happened for me when I retraced his steps. And it was just an incredible experience for me.
Yeah. Yeah. My guest this morning is Don Makin. The book is The 100-Year Walk, an Armenian Odyssey. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. So let's talk a little bit about the research process, because it strikes me as you had these wonderful notebooks that sound incredibly detailed, and that he, was very meticulous about his notes, which is fantastic. But it feels like it would be a very overwhelming process to... First of all, they're all in Armenian. So it feels like it could have been a very overwhelming process to find out about, a lot of these people were obviously killed so I would imagine there's not a ton of ancillary research materials to be had. And so talk about how you found all of this and found the people and ferreted out all of the wonderful facts that are in here.
Sure. Yes, it was very difficult. It was, and it's partly why it took me a decade to write this book, because I viewed my grandfather's story. I culled almost all the as many facts from it as I could, so I could expand his account. So when there were names, he wrote down so many names in his book, first and last name, and what town they were from. So I, just created this long list. And then as I did my research, I just expanded whatever information I could find about each person, and kind of this very large, file of each person. Who were the leaders of the town? Who was this? And who did people talk about? I went through all the newspapers from my grandfather's town looking for these names as well. And also what they were talking about at that, before the war, what was their village like? There's a newspaper article about how, a bull got stuck in the river, like we had to pull him out with the cart. And so it was all these little things. Also, they were starting, new schools and all this stuff. So, but I tried to find out as much information about everything that he wrote. He also, later on went during the deportation and during his death march, what towns he was in, what were the dates. And so what happened in those camps, because there were a lot of camps along the Euphrates River, and like internment camps, and what were the conditions? So who else, what other survivors wrote about the conditions of these towns during this period? So that's what I did. I just kept building around these, like a post, okay, this was, this town in January 1916. Okay, so then I went through consular reports from the Germans or the different various people, Americans, and what did they say about these places? And then the other people my grandfather was with, and there was one man in particular I became obsessed with, because he was in my grandfather's caravan where almost everyone was slaughtered, and he was from my grandfather's town, and my grandfather ran into him at the end of the war. And so I knew this man survived, because my grandfather writes about seeing him and couldn't believe that he had survived. And so this man, he was a teacher, and I just had this deep feeling inside that this man would have written about what happened. And if I could find his account, then that would expand what happened that night and what else happened that my grandfather didn't write down. So for years, his name was Haritun Atanasian, and I followed his trail after the war. He went to Romania, and I just started looking through every Romanian newspaper published.
Another language you don't speak.
Yet another, exactly. The research is from about six different languages and from six different countries, because after the war, the Armenians scattered, whoever survived scattered around the globe, and which is why there's such a large Armenian diaspora. And so I had to kind of follow them and where their stories went and who wrote them down. And so I finally, after years of research, I found that Haritun did write down about that night. And I found about eight pages of him in four pages in one newspaper and four pages maybe 15 years later in another newspaper describing that very night. And it fit just exactly with my grandfather's story. And so that scene, that when I reconstruct what happened that night, I wove in what Haritun wrote about, like how many people there were, how was it done, and what the desert looked like, and it just how it was so flat. It was difficult to disappear and to escape, and because you can see for so far, you know, if someone's running away. So that was the kind of research that I did that's woven into my grandfather's story.
One of the things you said that I think is really lovely is how many names and places he documented, because it strikes me that most of these people do not, you know, there aren't cemeteries, there aren't graves, and there's no memory. And so he preserved their memory and preserved who they were, but, you know, by naming them and by writing down where they were from, and gave them a small little slice of, you know, immortality just by acknowledging who they were in these books, you know, in his diaries. And you were able to do that for them. And I think that's such a lovely gesture, that people who were really erased and systematically, you know, I mean, not just killed, but really erased. It's really, really lovely that I wonder if that was a conscious decision on his part.
And you make a very good point. It is about erasure. And my grandfather, in his journals, writes about people who were dying and saying to him, if you survive this, tell the world what happened here. And so I feel that that was a big part of a big motivation for him, a big driving force. He had to speak up for the voiceless. And that was also what motivated me, was all these people, they're gone. And even the survivors are gone now. It's been, you know, it's been a century. And it's to give voice to the voiceless. And so to kind of find their accounts and to write down what happened to them. And many survivors could never, same with, you know, the Holocaust or any other, trauma, many survivors of the Armenian genocide could never speak about it. They even their children didn't really know what happened. It was something they didn't want to talk about or couldn't talk about. And my grandfather did. He could not stop talking about it. But for me, his story, it's so similar to so many other Armenians who survived or who went through this. And so his story is really, it's like so many Armenian families. It's really no different. My story is their story. My family story is their story, and in many ways. And I am just, the fact that he was able to write it down, I just feel it is such a gift to be able to give voice to the voiceless.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, I think, throughout literature, that very specific stories become universal stories. And you're right, that you were able to speak for an entire generation and culture that were voiceless. Is a gift.
My grandfather was through his journals.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, man, he really. So we're drawing down on our time, but I also want to talk a little bit about balancing atrocity. And, you know, there are so many passages of this book that are, they're lovely and yet very difficult to read. The torture scenes are some, you know, it's hard to read. So I'm wondering how you kind of found the balance to convey the real depth of what was happening to these people without alienating the reader and having people just say, you know what, it's too much. I have to close the book.
Right. Well, I try to tell it as simply as possible and not overly, you know, with words be too dramatic about it, because the events in themselves they're overwhelming. And so I had an editor friend give me great advice when I was starting, which was just said as simply as possible, because it's so powerful just on its own. You don't add to it. And so that was important to me. I didn't censor it. That was also important. There are difficult moments, but I felt that it had to be told. But I did, you know, you need a break from, well, many people, I do. When I'm reading something difficult, I need a break. And that was also partly why I'm in the story. So, you know, you're reading about what's happening to my grandfather, and then the book will shift to me following, you know, my grandfather in this middle of, you know, this moment of fighting for his life. And then, you know, the next chapter will be just, you know, me traveling through a century later. And there were some beautiful moments that happened to me when I was in Turkey and Syria. And so it's just giving you a pause and to be able to see the lens through more current, you know, see the situation through more of a present day and narrative. And then, you know, you can kind of go back to the story. And that was important to me, like whether or not you're seeing a play about something difficult and there's a joke. And it's just, you know, just take a step back and then you can kind of revisit the material.
I think it's really great advice to just report the facts and not commentate on, you know, how horrible it would be. I think that's really good advice for writing atrocity and writing difficult scenes, is just become a reporter and just say that these are the facts of what happened. And that, I think, it kind of did that detachment, I think, allows readers to more access to then put their own emotion on, or their own, you know, whatever, onto the facts. I think that's a really effective way of doing it. That's good. Do you have any advice for memoirists or people who are thinking about tackling their own family stories? Any advice for writers?
I would say it's similar to what Elizabeth was saying before, which was, you know, really stick with it. And I think if you have a really strong feeling inside and a strong intuition about something, that you have to do something, or that it's out there, like the material is out there and you just have to look, I think you should follow that. I absolutely, and don't give up and don't be discouraged, because there's so many walls that you hit as a writer, whether or not you're writing fiction or nonfiction, and you just want to throw everything out the window, or you want to quit. And I want to quit so many times when I was doing this book, and I didn't. And I just think I think you have to listen to yourself. And
it feels like there were a lot of points along the way that told you, keep going, you know, like, I mean, like meeting the Sheik, you were like, okay, that's a sign. I should really probably do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you just have to keep pushing. I mean, there's always going to be doors that close. And I mean, maybe people have very lucky, charmed experiences where it's all open and just, oh, go, 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 go. But mine wasn't like that. And I just would just say, just stick with it. And if you have this deep desire or dream, I think you should follow it.
I love it. I love it. Dawn McKean, this was fantastic. So you're going to be at the LA Times Book Festival. Tell us a little bit about where we can find you. We can find you online.
Sure. Yeah.
On Facebook. I know you have a page.
Yes. And Twitter. And so I have a website, dawnmckean.com. And I'll be at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books on April 9th at 4:30, speaking about the echoes of war.
Sweet. Are you doing other readings around? I feel like...
I'll be in Glendale also. I did a lot of my readings over the last few months. And I'll be in Berkeley at UC Berkeley, speaking to the campus on Genocide Awareness Week. Fantastic. And the Glendale Library in May.
Fantastic. Fantastic. This was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dawn McKean. The book is The 100-Year Walk, an Armenian Odyssey. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.